Welcome to the Mocking Cast, the podcast of Mockingbird Ministries. I'm David Zoll, your host, and in a few moments, I'll be joined by my co-hosts, Sarah Condon and RJ Heyman. We come to you every other week to discuss a few of the places where we currently see grace and its absence playing out in unexpected and compelling ways. We're glad to have you with us.
Praise the Lord.
Hey guys, what's happening? What's the latest? We haven't talked for a couple of weeks and a lot's been going on in Dave world, but I want to hear from you before I report in sunny Florida. RJ Heyman, the post Easter glow. How's it going?
Amazing. I mean, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed, but like
always with this guy,
it's right. It's amazing. We had an amazing Holy Week. We had an unbelievable Easter. We had five baptisms the week after Easter. I am just unbelievably grateful. And on top of it all, like, I hate to say this, the past 2 weeks here have just been glorious. Just like high 70s and dry and sunny every day. I'm way too tan because all Marshall wants to do is go to the beach and ride waves. And I can't take Jamie with me because she's terrified. So people at church are like, RJ, you're getting too much sun. You're looking a little leathery. So I don't know. I wear sunscreen, but like, we do live in Florida and I don't just play bridge. I do other things too. I don't actually play bridge at all.
I got to say, I was traveling in Canada this past week and talking to some people who listen to the Mocking Cast.
They hate RJ.
Everyone hates me.
They were saying, like, I think it's so funny when you give RJ a hard time about the glory story and everything going well, because, you know, when he shared his background and sort of some of the pain in ministry and a failed church plant and washing out in other ways. And I said, you know, that's A, why we feel the license to make fun of him, but B, why we also allow him to trot out absurd statistics like what he just did.
There were no statistics. I gave 30.
I'm sorry. You just gave numbers.
I'm sorry. Jamie's been so mad at me. My wife's
but it's
so
okay
mad.
Because we know that you were once dead but are now alive.
I'll be dead again soon. I mean, it's all going to come crashing down. So I'm just going to enjoy it while it lasts, knowing that a few years from now, it will be death and despair.
And it will have been documented on this podcast.
So people will have watched the rise and fall.
The rise and fall of RJ Heyman. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, please give us some pain and some angst.
Please give us something to go on.
I mean, I can always complain about things. Easter was great. I mean, it's our first Holy Week at St. Bee's, and it was St. Bee's is creative and interesting and sort of like you kind of never know what you're walking into. And that was so beautiful and unexpected. Easter was glorious, but I did have this bizarre thing happen where I thought I saw my mom in the congregation.
Whoa.
And that was really, it's the first time that's happened. And I'm now realizing this is super common, but like, there was like this woman in from behind. She looked just like my mom. So that was a little hard because then I like had to literally walk out of the service. Thank God my kids were sitting with my godmother, but I had to walk out of the service and just kind of completely fell apart. And I was like, well, happy Easter, you know, but.
Well, remember the Gospel of Matthew, that when Jesus was crucified, dead people came out of the tombs and appeared in the holy city. So there's precedent. There's biblical precedent.
That's really helpful, actually, because the other thing, I always feel like I sound crazy when I say this, but the other thing was like I was standing there staring at this woman. Like I could literally just see if she just turned her head, I could see my mom's face. Oof. And she was smiling. And I just heard Jesus say, well, isn't this where she'd be? Mm. So that's actually really comforting. Yeah, it was such a crazy thing. But
don't you think this is where she'd be? Is that
this is where she'd be. Yeah.
Wow.
It's Easter morning. Hello. Mm. Yeah. Mm. So anyway, but I didn't feel better until I got some alcohol in my system. So yeah, if you wanna fight that Holy Spirit feeling, just drink a couple of mimosas and it'll take the edge right off, folks.
And in some sense, can I say she is there? You know, one thing I always sort of say at funeral, like I pray funerals, you know, that these promises, right? What does Jesus say? Whenever two or more gather to my name, I am there in the midst of them. And your mom is with Jesus right now.
Yeah.
Right. So like if we're with Jesus and she's with Jesus, then like we are actually together, even though we just can't quite see it right now.
I mean, I was like fine with recognizing her until that was spoken over me. And then I was like, oh, hell no, I got to get out of here. I'm going to hyperventilate, you know? Yeah. It's such a powerful and painful and beautiful like reality. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, that's not complaining at all, but that's profound and serious and beautiful at the same time. So I guess I can complain. I've got terrible allergies. I mean, this is the
like
worst.
Brutal.
This is the period of like of the year, the 1 week where the pollen almost shuts down my entire existence. Like I just can't really operate in the world. RJ, do they have pollen in Florida?
Oh, a lot. Tons.
Oh, okay. That makes me feel
better.
But
do you know why allergies are so bad?
Why?
It's because there was this policy in America to only plant male trees because female trees produce fruit and fruit is like a pain to clean up. But all these male trees just pour out pollen. So like basically every municipality across the country only planted male trees. That's why there's so much pollen in the air.
That's insane.
For the last century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of trees. I mean, we need more trees, I think.
But, we need more trees. But
easy with the pollen, folks.
Exactly. Easy with the pollen.
I've been traveling a bunch, and it was almost unintentional, but I went up to Calgary, north of Calgary in Canada, to Canmore, very close to Banff. Ooh. And just had no idea what I was getting into. I was there for a theological conference, the Canadian Rockies Theological Conference. And
so cool.
I didn't realize that it was like one of the most beautiful places on the planet Earth.
Yeah.
And I mean, I feel like I'm so spoiled with travel at the moment because I got to do the Sundance thing in Park City. Mm. This feels
Did
not
you
unlike
jet
that.
Saturday, Dave's all?
Except for a little less commercial.
Take the Mockingbird
kind of
jet?
Nicer.
The Mocking jet?
Exactly.
Spirit Airlines. That's what it is.
Oh, yeah. Spirit.
Well, we're also should mention we are a week out or a little, by the time this comes out, a week out from our conference in New York City. I'm so excited. I'm so excited to see the two of you. We're going to record one in person and we're overflowing with people right now. So if people want to come drop in and say hi, I'm not sure there's any food or drink for you, but we would love
bring
to
your
see
own.
You. Bring your own.
Bring your own.
And do not even attempt to use the bathroom. So that was the... People don't realize the reason the cap.
There's a puck across the street.
The cap on the Mockingbird Conference in New York has nothing to do with whether or not people can find seats. There's plenty of seats in this sanctuary. It has everything to do with the infrastructure in the bathrooms, which were such an afterthought as to almost be non-existent. So thank you to Calvary St. George's, wonderful friends there, and what they put up with and the strain on their plumbing.
You need a toilet trailer. You need one of those like high-end toilet trailers.
We had one year, and guess what happened?
It didn't overflow. It stopped working.
No.
Got ticketed.
No.
The homeless people used
it. It's New York City. You have to have a full-time security person
there. Security guard.
Oh, no.
Someone went in there and passed out.
Oh, my gosh.
Was it you, Dave? Was it
enjoy
you?
Your it forgiveness.
Enjoy your forgiveness, but please don't enjoy it in the porta potty.
Passed out in the toilet.
Enjoy it in the park over there. Not
okay.
In the
I'm sorry, but all I'm hearing is Mockingbird has a homeless ministry. That's all I'm hearing right now. Okay.
Praise the Lord. Well, you all, let me ask you this question before we jump into this first piece. Do you like to like make brownies and like sort of the cake mixes and stuff like that with your kids? Do you ever do Betty Crocker?
I'm doing it tonight.
Really?
With Annie. Yes.
What's your favorite, Sarah?
The Ghirardelli, because Annie calls it Annie. We gotta work on Annie's letters. Annie calls it Chardonnay.
It might have something to do with her mother. That might be
just a long
She's
word,
like, well,
I guess.
Let's get the Chardonnay brownie mix. I'm like, you know that's not that word.
Sounds delicious.
I guess GH looks a little like CH. I mean,
yeah, I think that may be the issue. Yeah.
Well, I learned something this week about Betty Crocker, and it's related to this first piece. And this first piece is by Amanda Montell. It's in Marie Claire. It is an excerpt from her new book called The Age of Magical Overthinking. She talks about hobbies. In particular, she talks about adopting the hobby of flipping furniture at the behest of a therapist who said she needed to do something with her hands to help her root her in the present. But in the midst of developing this hobby for flipping furniture, by the way, is where you take like an old lamp or something you find in the back of a closet and you spray paint it and then, you know, maybe add a new shade or something like that and then list it and sell it for, you know, $50 or something like that. But she reflects on the power of the homemade, and we're going to get to Betty Crocker here. She says, nothing satisfies the spirit quite like building something yourself. At the same time, nothing has ever warped my perception of value with such efficiency. What is it about the human hand that when applied to an object makes it worth so much more, at least in our own eyes? She writes, the propensity to ascribe disproportionately high worth to items we helped create is a cognitive bias known as the IKEA effect. Its delightful name is an homage to the Swedish furniture company whose affordable products require assembly. Spending long nights splayed on the floor, struggling to piece together some sort of a bed frame is practically a coming of age ritual in our culture, a contemporary rite of passage as significant as the Amish Rumspringa. The IKEA effect was observed long before it was described. An oft-cited example comes from the mid-20th century, during the golden age of processed food. As the anecdote goes, in 1947, General Mills launched a new line of Betty Crocker instant cake mixes that tasted nearly indistinguishable from the stuff made from scratch. The product took off at first, but sales eventually slowed to a near halt. In a state of consternation, General Mills solicited the analysis of a Freudian psychologist who determined that the sales decline was a result of guilt. Homemakers felt that if all they did was add water, the cake was not truly theirs. They couldn't proudly tell their husbands and children that they'd prepared the fluffy confection with their own two hands. So General Mills responded with an unexpected marketing pivot. They relaunched the instant cake mixes with a new slogan, add an egg. Now, baking was easy, but not too easy. Betty Crocker's sales soared. We like things better, she writes, when we've had a hand in creating them. According to the IKEA effect's coiners, this fact isn't due merely to guilt, but rather something more existential. What truly displeased Betty Crocker consumers, they argued, was the sobering shock of insignificance. New technology insinuated that mothers' home cooking, and thus mothers themselves, were unnecessary. No one likes the feeling of being rendered irrelevant. The cake mix did not technically require additional ingredients, labor, or expertise, but that egg fulfilled consumers' desires for affectance, the spiritually satisfying notion that we caused something to happen in the world. The egg made people feel like they mattered. Now, I'm going to continue reading from Montel, but I'm just wondering what you make of this fascinating add an egg being the, I almost, as a Christian, I cannot help but see it a little bit as a metaphor for God, and that God almost allows us to feel like we're adding something, even though it's completely unnecessary to the sort of God-human relationship or the salvation tango, as it were. But I also do enjoy the cracking of the egg as my kid's favorite part of that whenever we make brownies or cookies or something like that. But what do you think about the IKEA effect? Do you notice it in yourself?
It's funny. So my mom loved baking mixes, and as college students are often wont to do, I went to college and started like actually baking, like because I had a kitchen, and I remember saying to her, like, really judgmentally, like, you never made anything from scratch, or like, you made two things from scratch, but you didn't make anything else from scratch. And I could tell she felt bad. And now that I'm a mother, and like, I can't even fathom getting out a measuring cup right now. It was so hard to not say the F word before I said measuring cup. like they're like this minor miracle to me that my kid can feel like loved and taken care of. And, you know, so I mean, that definitely occurs to me. I wonder when you talk about this from a theological perspective, if like, but that's part of the grace of God, is that God knows that his creation needs to feel like we're doing something, you know, like just for our brains and our hearts. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, we sort of feel that way sometimes. And then, of course, then you're given these like crazy moments of awe when you realize like you really didn't, you aren't doing anything, you know, which is also grace. So I don't know.
No, she writes that we need the allegorical egg. The egg gives us purpose. The egg tells us we deserve to be here. And there's a grace in God sort of allowing us to feel that way, even if it warps very quickly into self-righteousness. But RJ, what were you about to say?
I don't bake. Jamie does, though. She is amazing. And she does do most. I mean, she cookies, like her oatmeal chocolate chip cookies are like the best thing on the face of the planet. Aww. And she'll make them like once a month when she just feels like it. And then she'll wrap up half of them and send them to our kids in college. And like, they're just so excited to get them. So she's great that way. I like to cook, but I'm not a big baker. It made me think, sorry to be the Bible guy, you know, but it totally makes me think of Ephesians like 2:8-10.
Never,
you
know, apologize for being the Bible guy.
Well, I don't know.
Where are we?
Everyone's pushing the fast forward 30 seconds button on their phone right now.
No, they do that when David reads.
They do that when I read. That's when they do it.
What was Paul say? For by grace you've been saved through faith. It's a gift of God, not the result of work, so that no one may boast. For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he has prepared in advance for us to do.
He didn't look at that. That was all off the top of his head, everyone.
That was crazy. He like closed his eyes.
Beautifully done to RJ. And
I love it. Right, I love it because it's all great. It's
totally.
It is. It's all done. It's a gift. It has nothing to do with you. And then God has just like given you some stuff to do so that you'd have something to do while we're kind of running out the clock, because that's all we're doing. We're just running out the clock. And it reminds me of it's kind of a preacher's tale, which I generally hate, but it's a good preacher's tale about a father wakes up one day. He's got a little son, you know, maybe 3-4 years old. And the son says, "What are you doing today, Dad?" And Dad says, I'm building a stone wall outside. And so the boy says, "Can I help?" And so they spend the day and the dad builds the wall. And really all the boy does is like play in the mud puddles, you know, chase butterflies, maybe place a pebble or two there. And at the end of the day, they come inside and mom says, "What'd you guys do today?" And the little boy says, "Daddy and me built a stone wall." Yeah. You know, and I think that's actually is a beautiful metaphor for like us in the Christian life, right? Like we're the little kid who's just playing in mud puddles, doing our own thing, probably misplacing stones, creating more work than we are value. But God in his grace allows us to be part of what he's building.
I think that's what we're talking about at its best. I think at its she goes on to say a few more things about how this plays out. She says the IKEA effect is at its core another effort justification bias.
Totally. Yes.
How we love to defend our most expensive, time-consuming, irreversible choices. The ironic link between a task's arduousness or permanence and our eagerness to rationalize it is why, when faced with a heavy decision, like whether or not to attend grad school or have another kid, psychologists caution against asking the advice of someone who just did it themselves. If a person endures involuntary pain on their path toward achievement, say they get a paper cut while folding origami, that won't make them appreciate the end result anymore. But if they willingly endure suffering, that paper crane will start to look like it's made of porcelain. She says, it doesn't take a psychologist to intuit that sharing an object you made inspires much more pleasure than displaying something you bought or something that technically belongs to a large company. This is even and especially true when the creation didn't turn out quite as planned. She ultimately defends the beauty of handmade objects, the sort of stuff that you add, not just added an egg, but a whole coat of paint. And, because she says the flaws are what give a thing life.
Totally.
Flaws are what give a thing life. I thought that was beautiful because those are.
Yes.
And she gives the example of browsing Zillow at night and realizing that you see a lot of cookie cutter homes, and then you find the one home that's got like a pizza oven in the shape of a hippopotamus. And like that's the thing that sparks kind of emotion and conversation. Some people it sparks joy and some people it sparks revulsion, but that's the thing, that the flaw is where the life is found. And I thought that was kind of a beautiful observation. It also was encouraging to me on the eve of a Mockingbird conference, because one of the things I'm told about our conferences is that they feel sort of homemade, which I think is a nice way of people saying they don't feel that professional, and possibly authentic is the nicer way of saying that. But I'm always self-conscious that they're not as smooth or as branded or as, you know,
slick.
But Montel gave me justification, I guess, for the kind of shoddy result that we sometimes achieve. I don't know.
This is also why people are obsessed with Alfa Romeos and Maseratis, and they're not so passionate about Toyotas, because Toyotas just always work and Italian cars don't, you know, but it's the flaws that make them interesting. I mean, they're fast and fun, but they also break down, and it's kind of your temperamental mistress, you know, something like that. There was also an article recently about this AI program that film people are using to kind of clean up old movies and make them a little bit better, like remove the static, remove the overexposures, and like film lovers are freaking out because they're like, no, don't take out the flaws. Like, that's what makes it interesting. Like, we don't want it perfect.
Yeah.
We want it a little, you know, authentic, a little more authentic.
Interesting. That's why Nick Cave doesn't like AI written songs. What else? Do you have anything else to say about this, Sarah, as you prepare to make Chardonnay brownies?
Yeah, I just want to say, for anybody who's listening to this who doesn't do stuff with their hands, I hate to do stuff with my hands. I'd much rather buy it at TJ Maxx. So I just marvel that there are people that exist in the world that are like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to spray paint this chair. So yeah, that's the only thing that I'm like, there's some.
She does all that. She's amazing.
Wait, yeah. I recall a story, Sarah, of you spray painting like a couch or something like that, or lawn furniture. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. I mean, sure. And it's ugly.
And you don't like it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like should have paid somebody to do it. Yeah. Should have paid somebody. I don't know. It's just, I don't look at it and feel warmth. Do you know what I mean? I look at it and I'm like, damn, that is ugly, but I'm not going to do it again. So anyway.
You learned your lesson.
I learned my lesson. Yeah.
Well, on to the next thing, which also these first three articles have to do with sort of the longing for reality and kind of humanity and just real life in a world that feels automated and sometimes consumer driven and even AI driven. This is from our friend Sarah Hinlicky Wilson, who writes a wonderful newsletter called Theology and a Recipe. And she wrote one called Bad Pie. Now, I'm not going to read the section about bad pie because that's great, but she lives in Tokyo. She's a theologian who lives in Japan. I've been spending a lot of time in Japan in my imagination because I've been watching Shogun and Tokyo Vice. And she asks in this newsletter, she says, because how many things do we now know only in their fake versions? So this goes from furniture flipping or the IKEA effect into something quite a bit darker. She said, there's a new memoir that's come out in Japan and has done extremely well. It's called Rental Person Who Does Nothing. Came out this year. It's a memoir by a man who lives in Tokyo who concluded that he had no skills at anything and moreover didn't want to do anything. So he started offering his nothing on Twitter. If you needed a human being around, not to do anything, but just to be there, you could ask him. So for the cost of transit, he'd show up and do the nothing for you. Sarah writes, I can easily imagine Westerners who have no direct experience of Tokyo culture imputing all kinds of warm and beautiful sentiments to rental person. Ah, freely given grace, or a ministry of presence, or a generous beneficence to lonely people with no one in their lives. Rental person strictly disavows such high-minded motivations, and that is a tale in itself. But the more revealing part comes from the requests that people sent him. Here's an example. Someone writes to rental person, says, I wonder if you could come and meet me off a plane at Narita Airport on Wednesday, December 19th. My granny died on the morning I left for a period of study abroad, and I couldn't go to the funeral. I was very fond of her. I'll be visiting her grave after I get back, and I'll be feeling sad when I arrive. So it would be nice to have someone waving at me when I get to the airport. You might well wonder, why should she ask a total stranger? Rental person reports, she explained how she hadn't seen her friends for ages and didn't want to talk to them about her sadness at not being able to go to the funeral. In other words, sadness is a burden you don't want to put on your quote-unquote friends, evidently, because friendship is mandatory performative happiness. Rental person has a darker take on it. Rental person writes, talking to someone about a problem is to put your weakness in their hands. Mm-hmm. And who wants to give another person that kind of power? Here's another request. Hi, I'm in the hospital. Would you come and visit me? I've been here for a month and none of my family has come to see me. It turned out that the requester was in the suicide watch ward of the hospital after a drug overdose and, for all intents and purposes, abandoned by his family. A stranger paying exactly one visit in response to a Twitter request shows up instead. As the memoir progresses, he reveals his uniformly negative experience of human sociality in the form of crushing obligation. Every named relationship, he writes, entails particular things that you have to do, certain expectations that you have to meet. And that's exactly why he enjoyed his rental person gigs. They're one time only, no previous relationship, no future relationship. And he generally praises the kind of connections that social media enables. This type of relationship, he writes, neither friend nor acquaintance, can be very agreeable. It allows people to feel less isolated while letting them avoid the obligations of more fixed relationships. What do you guys think about this?
Yeah, I think on the one hand, it's you can see how something like this would devolve into, it sounds crazy, but like, you know, relationship with robots or artificial intelligence, right? Like just something to show up when you don't really want, when you want something or someone around, but you don't really want anyone you know or have any obligation to. So I think that's interesting. It made me think of, you know, Her, the movie with, you know, Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson, which is so amazing. It also made me feel like he doesn't want to say this, but he is kind of Jesus, you know, Jesus who shows up and who doesn't, sometimes feels like doesn't do anything, doesn't want anything, doesn't require anything, who just shows up, you know, and what these people are actually offering is kind of prayers for someone to show up in their life who doesn't, that they can expose their weakness to, that they can share their weakness with and is not going to take advantage of them, or, you know, when they let their guard down is not going to sucker punch them or take advantage of them, abuse them. And it is incredibly sad that so many people feel like they don't have anyone like that in their life, you know, that they have to be something for everyone in their life. And I'll also confess that I feel that way a lot of the time. You know, I think one of the struggles of pastoral ministry is finding people that you don't have to be anything for, you know, because you're always the priest, or you're always the priest's wife, you know, or you're the pastor. So finding people that you can sort of really be yourself with and sort of show your humanity to and weakness to. So I this is pretty amazing. I kind of want to buy the book and read it this summer or something.
It's written by Shoji Morimoto. Shoji Morimoto is the name.
Wow.
Sarah, what do you think?
I really appreciated what RJ said, because I do think this is a great example of, like, it doesn't matter how we feel about things, like, God is going to use them the way that God wants to use them. And this, that there is a certain amount of, like, right beauty to what this person is doing. It actually reminds me a lot of being a hospital chaplain, because you would show up in rooms that there wasn't any family there, or rooms where, you know, the doctors were refusing to give meds because there were addiction issues. Or, you know, I always think of the patient who his whole family was like, we don't know how, like, how he has liver failure. We don't know how he has liver failure. And then it's like, you know, I go and I look in his charts and he's like a lifelong alcoholic and a closeted gay guy who's clearly struggling. I mean, I I'm privy to that, right? And I can have those conversations with him. You know, but he died with his family sort of being like, we don't know what happened, you know, willfully or not, right? So I do think about that, but it also reminds me of this sort of thing that's happening. I've seen more on sort of mom accounts on Instagram. So there's this woman who I was just completely enthralled by. She's like this high-level executive in Manhattan. She has that kind of like, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I mean, she's not reading the Bible. Don't get excited. But, you know, to like do yoga and like stare at a candle or whatever people do. And then I get my kids up and then, you know, I take them to school and then, you know, she goes into like all this like high powered work stuff. And she talked about like how one of the important keys to that is that she only has low maintenance friendships.
Oof. Yes. Right. People are exhausting.
Meaning like I like work takes up a huge, I mean, this is the kind of lady that like when she's not working during the day, she's doing some symposium on women in leadership that night. You know what I mean? Like, and kind of an endless justification of self at its worst. And she basically doesn't have friends. I mean, that's like what, you know what I mean? Like that's,
you can't.
Yeah. And I was just like, this is bleak. Like this really, I thought this was going to make me want to get up in the morning and stare at a candle, but I think I'm just going to sleep in and like text my friends in the morning over my cup of coffee. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it just was like really such a bummer, but it reminds me of this, like, how can we, like, I feel like low maintenance friends is like, I feel like there are low maintenance marriages. I don't know if anybody is like actually saying that now, but I think there's a lot, you know, I think there's this idea of like, we're just going to function in the same space and not spend the time like being vulnerable to each other and going deeper. And I mean, life is really short, you guys, you know, it's like
Sarah Wilson is basically saying this is a very thin replica of the real thing that when this becomes what people, the only thing they know, it's better than nothing, but it also makes you sad. Like she was like, what, you know, wait till you just try good pie, AKA a friend who loves you in a non completely draining way, but is actually able to give to you.
It's actually, I mean, I've never hired a prostitute, but I do wonder about the emptiness one feels, right? When this, you have this intimacy with this person and then
it's relational and prostitution.
Right. And in the moment, your heart and your brain are probably doing some sort of thing that's like, this is a person who will care about us, right? Because we're doing this thing with them. We're having this experience with them. And then they just leave. So I don't know if it's better. I don't. Do you feel better afterwards? I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I can neither confirm or deny. But I do think that there, like, I'm also reminded, remember the Craigslist confessional stuff where that Helena, who spoke at our conference a few years ago, and she just offered to listen to people and basically just be a warm body and sort of, and I mean, there's a little more active, there's active listening that she was doing with people, but there was no, she wasn't contributing anything to the equation technically other than sort of just being a person.
Right.
And there is something gracious about that. And but I do love how Sarah Wilson is able to sort of like, well, before you go down that rabbit hole of like a ministry of presence, just know that the person here who's doing it was very cynical about the whole thing and basically saying, I like this because I get to interact with people without having to reveal myself or contribute in any conceivable way. So there is this kind of like, you know, when we're talking about, you know, the contributing to the God human relationship, there's a little bit of a mirror of it here, but it's a quite a depressing one to me. And she says that she thinks we're, you know, Tokyo's just 10 years ahead of the rest of the world. I don't know if that's true, but perhaps again it puts church in the premium that of just being around other people that you're sort of obliged to greet and say hello to. Maybe that's another selling point for the church.
Well, and I'll say, you know, last night we had a little Zoom with the bishop for our confirmands, and he asked them, you know, what they loved about the church. And I remember one person saying, like, you know, I live alone, you know, but at church I never feel alone.
Yeah.
You know, I always feel like people are with me and I have a community and I have a home and people care about me and they know me, and just how powerful that was in her life. So,
well, we're going to move on to one more instance of the longing for connection and God, I think, meaning, purpose, as evidenced in the eclipse about a week after the solar eclipse that occupied all of our attention for about 3 to 4 minutes. And Todd Brewer wrote a wonderful piece on Mockingbird called Longing for Enchantment. This is what he writes. He says, you might have heard by now, but a few days ago, the sun was temporarily obscured by Earth's nearby satellite planet, the moon. With nearly half the country residing within striking distance of peak totality, the anticipation and fervor was sky high, for what some deem to be the most extraordinary sight nature has to offer. Todd writes, I'm sure it was very cool to see, but calling it life-changing strikes me as grasping at straws. An eclipse is spectacular, but revelatory seems a bridge too far. But for Todd, he says, if there was any marvel on Monday, it was the way that such a supposedly rational, scientific, post-Enlightenment society gaped at a black sky and believed it briefly touched transcendence. Mm. We might not believe in Zeus, Thor, or for that matter, God, but we still long for enchantment. And he goes to – he talks about how enchantment is big business today from sort of the way they that movie stars are trying to lure you back into movie theaters to, you know, hey, you've already climbed Mount Everest. I hear the views from space are breathtaking. So get on this space cruise through SpaceX. He writes, perhaps second only to a desire to be known and loved, the desire for enchantment touches most aspects of everyday life. Never one to be one-upped by Wall Street hedge funds, the church has likewise stepped up its enchantment game in a variety of ways. One approach has been to emphasize God's superabundant presence within the ordinary small things of life, a kind of medieval mysticism for middle-class suburbia. Everything, it is said, is sacramental, revealing God's presence and character to the one who has eyes to behold him lurking in, under, and with the unremarkable everyday occurrences. This view is not without scriptural warrant, as the psalmist David declares, "Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence?" But if everything is sacramental in precisely the same way, nothing is actually sacramental. Mm. If God discloses himself equally everywhere, we are either overwhelmed by the ubiquity of a God who can't seem to be pinned down, or delighted to find a God who agrees with us entirely. Another response to the competitive marketplace of enchantment pushes in the opposite direction. Rather than elevating the everyday to sacramental status, the church should become more extraordinary and less profane. We equate antiquity with authenticity, and then the answer becomes to the crippling burdens of modernity is a return to pre-modern forms of belief or practice, the weirder the better. In this way, traditional Latin masses, mood lighting with fog machines, and Christian solstice celebrations can be guided by the same aesthetic impulse to provide an experience that enchants by being as distant from everyday life as possible. When the sacraments are pressed in service of enchantment, they lose their cruciform character to become yet another theology of glory. When the church takes part in the enchantment arms race, it obscures the very thing that makes it so unique. Christianity is very much weird and decidedly not modern, deserving of devotion and awe, but its glory and splendor always appears in the form of its opposite. I will read his doozy of a closing paragraph in a moment, but do you guys notice this, the yearning for enchantment and otherworldliness? And when I was traveling back from Canada, I have to say, I saw there were people with, you know, I guess they're eclipse chasers, and they were wearing t-shirts about sort of like totality 2024, and they looked like, you know, there's a real subculture that I had never known about.
Pilgrims. And,
you know, it reminds me of that movie Twister.
Yeah. I mean, so I have friends who aren't believers who really, really, really love the eclipse and, you know, who saw the one in 2017 and then was like, this, like, I've got to, you know, this have been planning for this one. Right. And, you know, they sent pictures to me and there were like festivals that happened around this. I mean, it is very, there is a certain amount of like devotion, right? And even community, right? In these spaces. And then sort of like the cynical like church lady in me is like, damn, if y'all like that, you'd love Easter. You know, it's like, I just like, if you really want to see like something crazy happen, you know, come to Easter, find yourself an Easter vigil. Those are crazy. I mean, I don't want to just write off the fact that for some people, science is like beauty. Science is like, science feels like devotion. Science, you know.
Awe.
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
the
totally.
Hubble telescope. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, but it is science.
It's not science, though.
Well, I mean, it's science. It's
the natural world, but I'm not sure I would call it science.
Well, it's astronomy, right? I mean, it is like a science, you know, like people are out there with telescopes, like, so it is this thing that we know is going to happen. And I think for me, the things that are most moving, and probably this is part of me being Christian, are the things I don't expect. Mm-hmm. So the things I can't plan for, you know?
Yeah. I'm always reminded of Dr. Leo Spichemin in 30 Rock saying, medicine is not a science.
Talk to a doctor. It's not.
I'm just kidding. Well,
it's an art. Seriously.
RJ, who we're getting the, it's an art. Okay. All right.
That's what they said. It's got a lot of guesswork. Yes.
RJ, you've got things to say here. Just unload on us.
Yeah, come on, RJ, tell us. What is science?
Well, you know what I was doing during the eclipse? I was doing a wedding outside.
Oh.
And they had not planned it. It was a total coincidence. But I was doing a 3:30 p.m., like while totality was, well, it wasn't happening in South Florida. It was only partiality. But it was during the eclipse, which was kind of wild. I didn't watch a lot of the coverage. I watched some of the coverage. I know people who watched a lot of the coverage. And apparently a lot of the coverage was kind of interesting because people talked over and over again about how unusual this is in the universe. That if you look in the universe, there's almost nowhere you can go where a moon is positioned in such a way that it is almost, that it's like exactly the same size as the star that a planet is orbiting. So it's like an infinitesimally, you know, small chance that we would – that that would even occur. Then the fact that we're like the only known life in the universe here on this planet, and then the fact that we actually have the eyes and the brains to perceive this incredible thing and to marvel over it. And some commentators on TV were kind of like it's the kind of thing that makes you maybe believe in God.
Mm.
You know, like maybe this is all just random chance. Or maybe this happens all over the universe because it's because we live in the multiverse and blah, blah, blah. Who knows? But that's all speculation. What we know is this is a crazy, crazy thing. And maybe it is true that the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament showeth his handiwork. You know, like maybe it's God just kind of showing off. And I know what you mean. Science, like, is it? I don't think it's, I think it's beauty. It's because we can't, you know. There's a science to the about the light of it and the astronomy. I get what you're saying, but it's history. It's not probable. Let's put it that way. Hmm. It's not probable that this would happen. It's not likely that this would happen.
Interesting.
But it happened. And everyone's right. Like, "Oh my God, that's the most amazing." I mean, my boys were together on the quad in the University of Texas, and the Texas Marching Band was playing Thus Spake Zarathustra. And the climactic moment was at the moment of totality, and everyone like lost their minds. You know, mm-hmm. It's just like the most amazing thing. And it's like, okay, yeah. you can water it down to just chance, or you can say, wow, what a gift, you know, and maybe there's something behind this. I also think to tie it back into the previous thing that we were talking about, I think people are more comfortable kind of worshiping something like this, as opposed to like Jesus or God, because the eclipse doesn't want anything from you. Or they think the eclipse doesn't want anything. Like I remember
it's a cosmic rental person, is that what you're saying?
Maybe. You know,
it's a cosmic
It's a miracle. It's a 4-minute miracle. It's a four. What'd you say, Sarah?
God, she said it's a
cosmic prostitute.
But they think a friend of mine in college, I've talked about this before, who would come to church with Jamie and me. She's like, you know, I kind of want to become a Christian, but I'm really worried he's going to like send me to Africa or something, you know? And it's like, well, he might, but maybe that's actually, you'll find out what you want to do,
right?
You know? Because people I know who are in Africa, they're there because they want to be there. There's right. Where they'd rather be. So I think people are scared to embrace something like God because they're scared of being known, of having something demanded of them, you know, that they don't, if they understood just the grace and unconditional love of Jesus, they might be a little more willing to engage him, something like that. But I think we do have this yearning for something bigger than ourselves.
I got to say, I do see what he's talking about in terms of the sacramentology, in terms of a way to kind of enchant your church service more and more. Either everything is holy or we're going to sort of reenact pseudo-pagan like rituals at our church service to make you feel just like you've exited the modern era. I don't know how... I don't want to poo-poo these things because I think that church should be creative and trying to figure out what actually resonates with people. But it is hard not to roll one's eyes a little bit at the everyone doing communion at all times in all places feels like as it does seem to pit that against preaching in a way that I think is unfortunate.
But I think the best, like a newcomer to our church was saying, and I think this is probably true for St. Bee's and Christ Church Charlottesville. He said, RJ, you know, I've been to churches that were all transcendence and no relatability at all. Yeah. Like it did not connect with my life. And I've gone to other churches that were just 100% relatable, but there was no transcendence at all.
Yep.
But he said, but what I love about your church, and I think there's some value to this in the Episcopal tradition and other, you know, there's the mystery and the beauty and the liturgy and the history and the rootedness. And there's also the relatability and the personal address and the, and I think bringing those two things together, right? Like bringing God down to people,
yeah.
You know, bringing making Jesus, the God of the universe, effective and relatable to the lives of actual people living actual lives. I think that's where kind of that can be the power of church, is marrying those two things.
It's very hard to hold both of those things. Yeah.
But yeah.
Sarah, what were you about to say?
I don't know. I mean, I actually am quite moved by the idea of everybody doing communion all over the world across different denominations on a Sunday morning.
Totally.
I find that incredibly moving.
Yes.
And when I think about the different time zones and how there's just waves of this that happen around the globe, like that's really beautiful and moving. You know, there's a sort of, I don't know that anyone actually says this out loud and I probably shouldn't, but there's like a little bit of a joke to me at St. B's where there's like maybe this alternative congregation that just like hangs out and chats during church, because there are, I mean, they come in eventually, right? But they're, you know, I walked past the other day, and this wasn't during church, it was during formation, and there was like a picnic table full of dads y'all's age just hanging out.
Love it.
And I was like, that's incredible. Like, that's incredible. Like, that these guys are here, that they love each other enough and are in deep enough relationship that they want to spend this time together. Like, that's just as important to me as the formation happening, as the sacrament happening. And I mean, I think it's really beautiful when you can have that sort of all in, you know, the same space. I mean, you guys know me. I don't have the highest view of like the Eucharist, right? But I do think it is one of the remarkable, beautiful, transcendent things that happens.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that one of the gifts of the Eucharist and doing communion is that it's, what that I love is that you can go to any number of churches and it's done well if they just sort of follow the liturgy, and it's great.
Sure.
Yeah.
But the same does not hold true for preaching. And I don't see why the two have to exist. What it sometimes feels like you get one or the other, as RJ sort of said, and that the thing that you do by the book is the sacrament stuff. I think that the stuff that you need to train and emphasize and tell people, hey, you also need to talk to people as though they're in pain and as though they need to, that this stuff that they're about to do in the Eucharist matters and stress the what they're about to receive, that they're just a rental person in this equation. I mean, I don't want to begrudge the rise of everyone adopting basically our forms, let's face it,
the Catholic forms.
But I also think if you're actually in our tradition, this is especially true when I went to a Jesuit university, and I'd go to Mass occasionally, and the preaching was a bad afterthought. I'm sure there are great Catholic preachers out there.
Yeah.
But it was so...
There's an excellent one in Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sure there are some great Catholic preachers out there, but the ones I've been exposed to are simply, it feels like it's so deprioritized as to be almost patronizing to the churchgoer. Maybe I'm just letting my Protestant flag fly here in an unhelpful way. But I guess what I'm trying to say is the marriage of the two is what's amazing. And the harder one to come up with is usually preaching that engages the heart and the mind. And it doesn't devolve into just law and to actually, you can't be a rental person here. You need to pull your own weight. Yeah. As an example of preaching, let me read to you the end of what Todd says, because he wants to reference the other eclipse that we're told happened when Jesus died, that the sun, that it went dark. He said, in the hours before Jesus gave up his spirit, we're told that darkness covered the whole land for 3 hours. In the ancient world, crucifixion was intended by the Romans to be a public spectacle, a display of absolute Roman power. Crowds would gather to see the condemned have their life slowly drained from them. While the heavens might declare the glory of God, on that day God declared who he really was, a condemned criminal who died for the sins of the whole world. I wonder which spectacle that day drew more people's eyes. Was it the inglorious death of Jesus or the enchantment of the sky? Which event was more worthy of their fervor and devotion? While many marveled at the heavens and turned to behold the obscured sun, the world was being redeemed by the one from whom they hid their faces. Those who seek enchantment will rarely gaze at a crucified Messiah. God did not arrive in this world with his power and majesty, but in humiliation. Though we seek to be enchanted by the glorious or incomprehensible, by that which exceeds the doldrums of the everyday, God enchants our hearts through the very thing we would never choose ourselves. Through suffering and shame, weakness and need, and a man who forgives the world with his dying breath. I thought that was pretty beautiful.
It is really beautiful. Yeah, it is.
Scholars actually do think, they because they can do this, science, this is science. There was an eclipse in the Holy Land on April 3rd.
Oh, so this eclipse is science. Okay.
No, I'm saying you can backdate the stars. There actually was. So we don't know. Maybe that's the day he was crucified or not, but there was actually an eclipse on April 3rd, 33 AD.
That's whether or not crazy. That was the day,
right?
That's and then also, I wondered.
And then this is the Washington Post. This is Oxford. Like, I'm not making this up. Google this. Apparently, Roman history says also there was a massive dust storm that day that kicked up. So there might have been an eclipse and a dust storm, because we know eclipses only last 4 minutes, and apparently the darkness lasted, 3 hours or whatever. So,
what?
Yeah, I know. Look at it. Look, Washington Post, baby. I'm not making Oxford. Amazing. I'm not making this up.
RJ Heyman, glory story extraordinaire and scientist.
Scientist
of the people. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to bring it back down very much to earth from the heavens with this last piece. It's called How Far Does Forgiveness Reach? It was written by Denise Uwimana. And it's part of her memoir called, it was published in 2019 from Red Earth, it was published in commemoration of the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Uwimana's Tutsi family was the target of the genocide. Her husband was murdered, but she and her three young sons were sheltered by Hutu neighbors and survived. She went on to found a significant NGO that offers spiritual material help to genocide victims. And in 2015, she traveled back to her home village on the anniversary of the genocide and asked if anyone had considered forgiving their attacker. This is what she writes. Despite my certainty, I felt apprehensive as I rose to address around 500 people. Were they ready for this? Has any of you been able to forgive? I asked. To my astonishment, at least a dozen hands shot up, voices calling, I have. One was Kensilde. I knew that her husband and five of her seven children had been killed. One son and daughter had survived, having been absent on the fatal day. All eyes were on this bereaved mother as she stood to speak. A gang of Interahamwe mobbed my house on April 9th, 1994, she began, referring to the Hutu militias that led the genocide. My family was caught by surprise. She stalled, then plunged on. A young neighbor, Emmanuel, killed my husband and five of our children. He was arrested and imprisoned the next year. But 3 years ago, in 2012, he was released. Before going home, Emmanuel tried to come to my house to humble himself. But the village had learned of his arrival and staged a protest, so he could not come that night. Next morning, however, he appeared at my door pleading for forgiveness. From that day to this, he told me, I have felt continual shame. Kensilde paused again, then concluded quietly. My heart had been freed from hate by then, because we widows had been reading the gospel together. Its message prepared my heart to forgive.
That's a hell of a Bible study.
Uwimana goes on to share how Kensilde and Emmanuel reconciled and remain surrogate family to this day. Kensilde has become like a mother to me, Emmanuel says. When I need advice, I go to her. Before I got married, I talked over the details with her. She is the local official who authorized my marriage. Kensilde broke in. Emmanuel is the one I ask for help when my house needs repair. He comes any time I ask to replace a window or mend the roof. If my cow has problems, I call him, and he knows he's always welcome to share a meal at my home. He is my son.
Ugh.
I read that, yes, to evoke tears and to, but as a reminder of the miraculous beauty and sort of gut-level, gut-wrenching and gut-level you know, hope of forgiveness when they ask the question. Plow entitled it, "How far does forgiveness reach?" And if this piece is any indication, we don't know the answer. I mean, it can reach pretty far. Yeah, you're right. One hell of a Bible study, right, Sarah?
Yeah, can you imagine this group of like widows and they're just all sitting around reading the gospel together? Like, I mean, that's a women's Bible study, mm-hmm. you know, like that's serious. So this has been on public radio a lot recently, and they were interviewing people sort of on either side of this and talking about this forgiveness that's come out of it.
The Rwandan genocide, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it does make me think of sort of, what is it? The Truth and Reconciliation Council. Is that, am I getting this right?
From South Africa.
Yeah. No, I know. Okay. So from South Africa. And this doesn't seem to have like a phrase yet. I'm wondering sort of that a lot of this feels more organic, right? This forgiveness and this sort of horrific event, which is fascinating to me. But anyway, I hear this gentleman talking, and he is one of the people who murdered other people, and he has been forgiven. And I heard this word that I've never heard before. The word is, and I'm not going to say it right because I think it's French, but genocidaire. Mm. And it is a person who murdered people in the genocide. And he said, like, which is like so interesting to me. It's so specific because he's not a murderer, right? He's not a rapist. He's not, right? He's a genocidaire. And he said, it doesn't matter how much they tell me they forgive me. And the interviewer said, well, how do you think of yourself today? And he said, I'll always be a genocidaire. Like, that will always be who I am. That will always be a part of my identity. And it makes me think about a lot of things. I mean, we, praise God, have not had that kind of an experience in our lives, but it makes me think about, I know this sounds silly, but it makes me think about like the ways that we screw up as parents, or the ways we screw up in like relationships with our families, and how it doesn't matter that like there's been forgiveness offered, but that always feels like a part of who we are. And I think it's rare to meet a Christian that really feels like that's not who they are on some level, even if you fully understand grace and, you know, have a capacity for all these things, like there's still part of you that identifies with that. I actually think you're a little like loopy and kidding yourself if you're not. Mm. And I think that is the freedom of heaven, that we are able to go there and actually and truly be freed from these labels that we carry about ourselves, you know, terrible parent, bad friend, right? I mean, bad spouse. I mean, I think that is like the one place where we find freedom from that. But yeah, it just stuck with me that like, this is the way this guy's always going to think about himself, no matter what.
Until heaven.
Yeah. And I think there's something really theological about sin there and the realness of it, right? That it doesn't even matter for most of us, right? That the person we've trespassed has forgiven us. I mean, it is huge, right? I'm sure there is relief in that. There is relief in that for me and my interpersonal relationships. But also, like, it is a part of who we are until we are set free, you know, in eternity with Jesus. Hmm. And that, you know, life is full of burden and we shouldn't expect any different. But also, this is like the baddest ass Bible study. I'm now obsessed with this Bible study. So
fly to Rwanda, find those ladies.
I know, right? Like, incredible.
RJ, what do you have to say? Last
I mean,
bit
on the
here.
Dark side, the Rwandan genocide is, it's one of those things where like, if you don't believe in demons, you know, it's like, what would possess people to slaughter a million of their neighbors?
I know.
In like 90 days.
It's crazy. Just
with machetes. Like, right. We're not talking about, I mean, by hand.
Right.
Just the most insane thing. Like, it's just about the darkest thing you can possibly imagine. And not just one person who had a psychic break, but like a whole country. Like, it's so sad and scary. Mm. And then as you were talking, Sarah, just thinking about, honestly, Paul, you know, who said, you know, this is a true saying and worthy of all men to be received, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the foremost, mm-hmm. you know, and that Paul was this morning in our men's Bible study, someone called him an assassin. He was a Christian assassin, killing mm-hmm. Christians, you know. But I remember someone saying that the glory and wonder of the gospel is that when Paul entered heaven, he did it to the shouts and cheers of the people he had put to death, which is like, ugh. Wow. And that's the Rwandan genocide, right? Like that when that genocidaire enters heaven, he will do it to the celebrations mm-hmm. of the people that he hacked to death with a machete. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And they're mm-hmm. going to live in perfect unity and love with each other and God forever.
Yeah.
And I just think for those moms, those women, those wives, that's, you know, the hope of heaven. I preached on heaven this last week. Like, that's the hope we have, is that everything will be set right. Most especially me, you know, and you. And we're not going to deal with all the stuff we deal with anymore. The anger, the resentment, the depression, the addiction, the anxiety, the fear, we'll just be set free.
Yeah.
Are you saying that people's sin and damage and brokenness will be eclipsed? I'm sorry.
You're so bad. Well, what did it say? John wrote this week, when we see Jesus, we'll be like him. When we see Jesus, we'll be like him. That's what it said in John's letter this week. That's a crazy thought.
Wow.
You know? Yeah.
Well, that's hope. That's the shred of sometimes you feel that in your bones, and sometimes it's just the shred of a hope of a hope of a hope, you know. But it certainly, if it's good enough for Cancilde, maybe it might be good enough for me.
Mm. Oh my God! These are the women. I mean, I these are the women. Like, these are the saints among us. Yeah. And I mean, I know RJ was going to close it out. RJ, I can't even handle what you just said, though, about the idea of demons in this, because I think about sort of all of the other ways that people have gone through genocide, and it's always been more hidden than this. I mean, this was crazy, you know? And for forgiveness to come out of this, I'm not someone to do the adoration of the saints, but how lucky would we be to stand in the hallway outside of that Bible study?
Yeah.
How lucky would we be to just stand by the door, you know?
Amen. So. Amen. Well, let's end it there. There's nothing else to say after that. Thank you both. And we'll see you. I will see the two of you in the flesh in New York City.
Yay.
In a week, and hope to see as many of our listeners as possible, especially, you know, if you're in New York and you can't come to the whole conference, but can stop in for just the recording, which I think happens at 5 p.m. on Thursday, the 27th, come by, say hi, take a seat. We'll get to chat for a little bit before things kick off, but we'd love to see you. And if you can come, Sarah's speaking the next morning. It's going to, I've gotten a preview. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. And I just am grateful for the two of you. I know it takes a lot of effort to get out of town like that. And I'm looking forward to it. So thank you both. And we'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Remember, you can find us on the web at www.mbird.com. And we'd always love to hear from you at info@mbird.com. Audio production for The Mockingcast is provided by TJ Hester. And if you like what you've heard, please drop over to iTunes and leave us a rating or review. Until next time.
Praise the Lord.